Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, it's a look at a third political party just taking hold in Pennsylvania called the Serve America Movement. And Inquirer sports writer Marcus Hayes gives his take on the Eagles' preseason, Phillies' playoff hopes, and Joel Embiid's $196 million contract extension. But first, New Jersey's budding marijuana industry will soon begin to grow its infrastructure. But when recreational weed is eventually available for sale, many consumers won't find dispensaries close at hand. The deadline for towns and cities to opt into the industry was this past Saturday, and approximately 400 municipalities said no thanks, at least for now. Interesting note here, many of those towns which are opting in are located in South Jersey. Also, 6 months after Governor Murphy signed legislation legalizing recreational weed, the state's Cannabis Regulatory Commission has published new rules governing construction of the industry, and local diverse business owners seeking to get in at the ground level will likely come out ahead. Mike Davis has been following and reporting on this long developing story for the Asbury Park Press and the USA Today Network, and he's along now with the latest. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mary. Glad to be here.
So hundreds of municipalities have decided they will not allow recreational marijuana sales just yet, perfectly legal. What are some of the reasons?
Sure. So in our reporting, these towns largely fall into two camps. There are towns that are just against it for moral reasons. You know, we've had stories about municipalities that kind of spit out the usual kind of myths and predictions you might hear about, like, oh, it'll bring in gang members and things like that. Those are kind of rare from what we found. A lot of towns are simply just felt like they were a little bit behind the eight ball because of, you mentioned those deadlines, that 6 month deadline that had been there.
Yeah.
And that was in place for both the state and the towns. So the states, the towns had to make these decisions, but the CRC didn't issue those regulations until a couple of days ago. So these towns really felt like they were being asked to make a decision with no guideline from the state on this.
So what does this mean eventually for consumers when they are able to purchase weed legally if their town has opted out? Is use restricted within township borders? I mean, how will that work?
Sure. So the one thing that the CRC says very clearly, and honestly, it's the law that Governor Murphy signed 6 months ago, is a town cannot restrict its residents from consuming marijuana as long as it's done within the confines of the law. And the easiest way to think about that is you can't consume marijuana anywhere that you can't drink alcohol and anywhere you can't smoke a cigarette. So you can't do it. You can't walk down the street smoking a joint. You can't do it in a public park or on a beach, places like that. The other thing is that a town can't restrict deliveries from happening in their town. So of the six different cannabis business licenses, one of them is for deliveries. So a town can't say, sure, you can have marijuana here, but you can't get it delivered here. Mm-hmm. No matter what, if you want to consume marijuana, you can have it delivered. And towns are also prohibited from taking any action, you know, kind of rerouting various businesses through that. You know, you think about wholesalers, distributors. So they can't say, don't bring your pot trucks through our town.
Okay. For those towns opting in, Mike, many of them are in South Jersey and Central Jersey. Why is that?
That's right. I mean, more than a third of them are in South Jersey. I mean, and the places kind of go across the gamut. I mean, you have folks like Atlantic City, but then you also have Evesham, Gloucester Township, Vineland. Folks that I've talked to, I said it's strictly kind of an economic thing. You know, there's sort of a realization here that if we're one of the early adopters in this, that means that there's going to be so many more months, maybe even years, that there will be sort of a leg up in getting that tax revenue and making sure that you're one of the first people in the business, you're one of the first towns in the business, and that means more tax revenue, more jobs for your residents, things like that. So it's really an economic driver in those towns.
Okay, to the new rules and regulations governing the industry, among the most impactful, local entrepreneurs will have a leg up over big out-of-state operators in vying for licenses.
Yeah, and it's not just local entrepreneurs. I mean, the one thing the CRC did, the main takeaway from the rules and regulations for me, is that it's really making social equity a very big, big part of this. And that was something that was said throughout the entire process when New Jersey almost passed it via legislation through the whole ballot campaign and everything, is social equity. And there's actually a whole group of licenses that the CRC refers to as priority review. And this is, you know, not just your standard diversity applicants and things like that, but actually making sure that people who have marijuana arrests on their record that are looking to get into businesses, that they're going to essentially be put at the front of the line on a rolling basis. So you may be stuck behind other priority review applications, but you'll have a leg up over the rest of the fold. And this is expected to be a major industry in New Jersey, considering how early the state adopted it compared to the rest of the state. So, I mean, there's really a chance for social equity to take kind of center stage as this goes forward.
You mentioned earlier, Mike, that some towns opted out for, you know, perceived moral reasons. Lacey Township is one. The mayor there famously said, "Uber some pot over if you need it that badly."
That's right.
But he also expressed concern, you know, that gangs might come in and undercut legal weed. Let's talk about how much legal recreational pot will cost in New Jersey and how the black market might react. I mean, there will be two state taxes and a local tax, correct?
That's right, yeah. A series of state taxes, as well as municipalities have the option to put on a 2% tax, but we know in New Jersey that there's never been a tax that's been turned down. So, you know, I think the thing to think about here is that that social equity stuff that I just talked about, I mean, that's important for a number of reasons, but one of those reasons, if you talk to legislators and the folks in charge of this stuff, is that they want to make sure that those folks in the black market, that they have a viable, cheap way to get into the legal market. You know, I mean, you're talking about license fees in the state that could be as low as $1,000 if you're something that's called a micro business, which means there's some restrictions on how many people you can hire, how much product you can sell, things like that. But yeah, I mean, the black market has kind of been forgotten about through a lot of the discussion. And obviously, the black market has been around far longer than anybody in the legal industry has been around. But I think the state's trying to do its best to make sure they can get involved there. Now, obviously, there will be people that refuse to get involved in the legal market for various reasons. But there is certainly a likelihood that in a lot of these towns, there is a black market. I think that the difference is in the towns like Lacey, where the mayor talks about the gangs that could come in. If you talk to law enforcement, if you talk to folks that are actually involved in the boots on the ground, I mean, it's really more of just the way things have always been. There have always been, you know, the typical stereotype of a corner pot dealer in every town in every state across the country.
Yeah. But I mean, back to the taxes, that the way legal weed will be taxed, we're talking at the end of the day, it's going to cost, what, about $350 an ounce, correct?
So, sure, that's right.
So, I mean, people in lower income communities, that's not going to be affordable. That's where I was going with the whole black market thing. I mean, does that give the black market an opportunity to move in?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it does. And, you know, this has been a problem in New Jersey for going back years, even with its medical program. I think the thing that the state would say is that a lot of that tax revenue is going specifically back to those lower income communities. You know, the biggest tax that's going to be placed on marijuana sales in New Jersey is going to go to those lower income communities. I mean, there's 20 specific what they call impact zones that have been stated. And those are the places that, like, you know, where there's a high population with high unemployment and over the years, really a high amount of marijuana arrests. And that's why the state's really trying to funnel some of that money back into those communities.
Okay, so a hedge against the black market in those communities, but still the question about whether the product will be affordable, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're still talking about a brand new product going out to market, and there's always going to be a bit of a markup on that, I think.
We're speaking with Mike Davis, a reporter covering marijuana legalization at the Asbury Park Press and the USA Today Network. We've got a question from Kyle who asks, what is one lesson that other states learned in their legalization process that New Jersey should make sure they consider? And, you know, one of the things which comes immediately to mind, Mike, is the packaging of marijuana products. Are New Jersey officials looking to try to avoid mistakes made by the first states to legalize, you know, for instance, gummies or cookies that are infused with cannabis in packaging them so that, you know, children don't mistake them for regular quote unquote products?
That's exactly the answer, Mary. And it actually goes even beyond that. Even from the beginning, for the last couple of years, New Jersey officials have been talking about making sure those regulations were in place, making sure there were no cartoon images and making sure nothing looked like a Sour Patch Kid or something like that. But actually, in the CRC regulations, it says very specifically that there are specific food products, food edibles are actually barred. So you're not going to be able to legally buy a pot brownie or a gummy, anything like that. Specifically, and I'm reading from the law here, it's only, quote, only syrups, pills, tablets, capsules, and chewable forms are allowed, end quote. So that really eliminates a lot of that stuff that they think is going to be marketable to children, or that children might mistake for an actual brownie or an actual cookie or an actual gummy worm.
Okay, will cannabis businesses be able to advertise their products, Mike? Will we see ads online or hear about the products on the radio?
Well, the advertising is certainly going to be a little bit of a different thing. I mean, the standard which New Jersey is adopting is that you need to make sure that when you're advertising, that you can prove that the majority of your audience over a certain amount is going to be 21 and older. Again, same thing, is they want to make sure that this is not being put in front of children.
And remind us, will folks from Pennsylvania or Delaware eventually be able to drive to Jersey to buy recreational weed?
Sure, yeah, and it's the same in every legal weed state, is that you need to provide ID that you are 21 years old. But in a lot of these states, I mean, there is a little bit of a tourist market and folks coming from other states to actually come and consume legal marijuana. The caveat on that is that it is illegal to bring it back to your state where it's not legal. I mean, that's drug trafficking. You can't cross state lines with a federally illegal drug. And as we all know, marijuana is still illegal on the federal level. But for somebody from Pennsylvania, from New York, you could travel into New Jersey, and from Delaware, you can travel into New Jersey, buy legal marijuana, and consume it here as long as you do it within the confines of the law, like I said before, not in public, not in a car, things like that.
Yeah, and speaking of which, one of the big criticisms of legalization has been we don't have anything in place like the breathalyzer to test people who might be driving while stoned. Has the state made progress in its rules in curtailing driving while buzzed?
There is, and it's the one big elephant in the room in this whole discussion has been there really is nothing. The state, the police officers across the state, they're able to be trained as drug recognition experts, kind of do some field sobriety tests. But you're right, there is no breathalyzer. There are some companies, especially out like Silicon Valley in California, which has had a legal market for a number of years now, they're actually making pretty good headway on a breathalyzer technology. But in my reporting, it kind of depends on who you ask. I mean, I've talked to some medical experts who say, you know what, even at its best, that breathalyzer may not be able to give you the info you need as quickly as you need it. So really, it's been the one thing in this entire discussion that there's honestly no good answer for. So the folks that are concerned about buzz driving, I think it's a very valid point. There's nothing that you can really do about it other than, pump some more money into police departments to make sure that there are more drug recognition experts. But there's another important point in that, which is that there's actually a New Jersey Supreme Court case that we've been waiting for a decision for a number of months now that could completely derail the whole DRE program. That, we could be in a position in a number of months where there are no drug recognition experts, and if there are, that what they say isn't actually admissible in court.
Wow. Okay, so one of the biggest questions here, did the Cannabis Regulatory Commission say exactly when recreational marijuana sales will begin?
You know, Mary, I've been covering this topic for about 4 years now, and that is the number one question I've gotten from every single reader, every single person who comes across our stories. I think that the short answer is no, there's no exact date. By law, the CRC has to pick a date within the next 6 months when sales can begin. However, they haven't opened up the actual licensing process yet. So they're going to have a date where sales can begin, but nobody technically has a license to do that yet. So I think it's going to happen sooner than later. It's going to happen at medical dispensaries. That's going to require a whole lot of movement from operators to make sure they have enough product for their patients.
It'll be a while. Okay.
It'll be a long time.
Mike Davis of the Asbury Park Press and the USA Today Network, thanks so much for joining us. And
Thanks a lot, Mary. I appreciate it.
Up next, Ethan Demme, Pennsylvania Party Chair of the Serve America Movement. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The United States has had a two-party political system in place pretty much since its founding. And even as third parties have periodically gained traction among the electorate, none has been able to breach the dominance of the current majority Republican or Democrat parties. However, some say the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th may prove a watershed moment, ripe for the success of a third party whose goal is to bring Americans of different views together, even as it works for transparency in the election process. Ethan Demme was a longtime member of the GOP and a former local party chair for the Republican Party in Lancaster County. He recently left the party and has opened a new chapter of the Serve American Movement in rather Serve America movement in Pennsylvania. SAM is a relatively new political party, and Ethan Demme joins us now to discuss SAM and the principles behind it. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
First, Ethan, tell us a bit about yourself and why you decided to step away from the GOP.
I live in Lancaster County, and I've been involved in party politics for about 20 years. I worked my first campaign when I was 14 years old in 1996. So I've sort of been doing the politics thing for a while. I'm currently an elected township supervisor in East Lampeter Township. And I used to be the Republican Party chair in Lancaster County back in 2010, 2011.
So what was the catalyst that helped you to determine that the GOP was something you needed to walk away from?
Well, even when I was in the GOP, I was always a little bit of a reform-minded person. So I've always advocated for things like term limits, for trying to get more transparency into politics, been in favor of gerrymandering reform. So I've always had some tension with some of the elements of the Republican Party. In 2016, I ran for the state Senate. Donald Trump was also running, and I was one of those hashtag never Trumpers. So at that point, I was much more disenchanted when my party chose Donald Trump as its leader. But it really came to a head with the election denials after the election last November. The big lie kept perpetrating, and my local elected officials just maintained silence or went along with it. And no one was standing up and saying, no, we had a fair election. President Biden is the elected president of the United States. I can't even get my state rep or state senator to say that in public now. And then on January 6th, watching the images come out of the riot at the Capitol building, that was the last straw. And then followed up with my congressman, along with the majority, vast majority of Republican congressmen voting to decertify the elections. That was the last straw to me. It was no longer a party of ideas. It was a party of personality. And that's when I left on January 7th.
Well, on that day, you and two fellow local Republicans wrote to the chair of the Lancaster Republican Party to say enough is enough. The denial of the 2020 election results by members of the party was outrageous, and that denying the facts fomented the seeds of sedition and led to the violence at the Capitol. So when you published this, Ethan, what sort of reaction did you receive from your fellow party members who were close at hand?
There was most folks were silent. I got a couple, you know, angry emails, but the vast majority of feedback I got was people encouraged me, thanking me for, and my fellow township supervisors for also standing up for something. A lot of private messages I got said, we wish that our congressman, our state representative, or our senator would say these things, but everyone else is silent. So thank you for standing up. So across from independents to Democrats to lots of Republicans who said thank you for standing up. So there are a lot of sort of, I call it the non-vocal folks who don't go to protests, who want good government, but they were very encouraging. So I was actually surprised at the feedback that we got. There was some nasty grams that you get, but that comes with the territory.
Well, so the Serve America movement, this party has been around, I think, since about 2017. Why did you gravitate toward SAM, and is there a platform? What are the goals of this party?
Yeah, so right after January 7th, a small group of us started talking about what could we do to make things better in Pennsylvania. We saw the Republican Party as unreformable from within, and we weren't fans of the polarization that we saw also happening in the Democratic Party. The big problem we see is polarization happening. There's good folks in both parties and outside of the party structure, but it's the loudest, you know, 20% of both parties that are dictating where those candidates go in the primaries. So we looked for something that was a little more ideological, flexible, didn't have any rigid boxes, and also stood for reforms like term limits, like redistricting reform, like open primaries. How do we get more people to participate in the process? So as we were talking through and holding some informal meetings, we came across the Serve America movement, currently led by David Jolly, former congressman from Florida. Had several conversations with him, and then we said, hey, we're all sort of pushing in the same direction. Let's just join forces. So myself and a few others launched the Serve America movement in Pennsylvania, and now we're jumping off on our new endeavor and trying to recruit some candidates for 2022.
Well, on the website, the Serve America Movement website, it says, SAM is a new party for a new majority. We are current and former Democrats, Republicans, and independents who have come together with a common goal to fix our broken politics in America. So can you be, I just want to clarify, can you be a Democrat or Republican and also belong to the Serve America Movement party?
Sure. And this has been something that's worked well in states like New York and Connecticut, where SAM has been established for a couple years, is they've run unity tickets where a Democrat and Republican run on the same ticket but endorsed by the SAM party. We're planning on endorsing candidates in both major parties who agree with us on our reform platform. Oftentimes people talk about a big tent party, and what they really mean is the Republicans used to be more big tent, the Democrats used to be more big tent, but that meant they were sort of right-leaning or left-leaning, but allowed some moderates. A true big tent is folks who have belief systems that dot across the entire political spectrum, and that's what we're trying to do. We think that people should actually argue and disagree and take their beliefs into the public square and have rigorous debate, but we should do it without being disagreeable. And at the end, we need to come to a consensus and actually govern. And that's what we see missing in Harrisburg.
Well, Ethan, Demi, obviously we're polarized, and in part because there's a tendency to demonize the other side. How do we achieve respectful dialogue with people we might not see eye to eye with on hot button issues like guns or abortion? You know, those issues that tend to get the hackles up fairly quickly. And how might SAM help to facilitate respectful dialogue?
I think it comes by modeling it, is one of the big things. I mean, I've got four little kids, and we try to teach them that they should express their feelings and tell people when what they're doing they don't like, and also explain what they want. And we have that dialogue, but at the end of the day, you do need to make a decision and move on. So the same way we should be modeling it to our kids is how we should be modeling it in government. Or in running for office. So hosting forums, we hosted an online forum prior to the last primary. Independents were eligible to vote for the ballot petitions. So we held a discussion. We didn't have a position on how you should vote, but we think people should be informed on that. So we held a discussion on that. It's really about how do we solve problems as elected officials. We need to listen. We need to define the problem. We need to actually engage with all the stakeholders. Invite people to public meetings. Oftentimes, whether it's local government, school boards, there's a large barrier of entry to engaging in local politics or even in state politics. And so how can we lower that barrier to get more of the general populace engaged in that political process?
You write that we are living the inverse of the old Tip O'Neill adage that all politics is local, that big tent politics is an issue. So tell us about why. So is local politics essentially being ignored in today's political process in large?
Yes. I mean, I've seen this in local races, even for township races where Republican mailers are being sent out saying we're not going to defund the police when no one on the other side of the aisle is running with that as part of their platform. You've got pictures, black and white pictures of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Nancy Pelosi in local township mailers. And your position on the previous president is the number one factor that is going to turn out candidates in a Republican primary. So that's sort of the polarization we see. When at the end of the day, whether it's local townships dealing with trash pickup issues like I deal with in East Lampeter Township, or it's a state representative in Adams County and a state representative in Dauphin County or Montgomery County, the issues are very different based off of those regions. But too often, what the vocal minority wants to hear is what's the national hot-button culture war topic of the day.
Yeah, let's talk about the character and the strength of elected officials. You wrote an op-ed earlier this month about what you see as a lack of leadership in this country. Some powerful words. The founders of this country anticipated the problem of ambition in elected officials and therefore created a brilliant system of checks and balances to mitigate it. But they did not anticipate widespread cowardice in public officials. The two major parties have rotted from within because far too few party leaders and politicians over the past 50 years care more about their country than their own careers and power. Tell us a little bit more about why you wrote this.
The idea of political service should be about service, but oftentimes it's become a career. We have public pensions for our school teachers and for our police officers because we want someone to stay in that job for a long period of time. It's a difficult job, and keeping someone in that job is beneficial. Keeping someone in Harrisburg is not beneficial to anyone, but people are more concerned about keeping their pension and their reelection than they are about standing up and saying what is actually true or not true. I've talked to many, many Republicans and Democrats, elected officials off the record. Every single one of them knows without a shadow of a doubt that the election was fair last year, but none of them are willing to say it out loud. And that's the failure of leadership that I see, where people are afraid to say what they know is true because there's a vocal minority that might protest.
Yeah, and maybe even lash out online.
Or show up to their houses. I mean, yeah. we've reached a tipping point in America where violence, actual physical violence, is a political strategy. Whether it's shutting down a street, whether it's attacking a capital, whether it's occupying a capital, we see this as not just both sidesism. We see violence as a political strategy, and we've seen it for the last five plus years. January 6th was the biggest, worst one, but that is now an actual strategy employed by political actors.
And you take aim at, quote, culture warriors on primetime cable news shows, end quote. How does consumption of this stuff affect viewers and eventually the political parties to which they belong?
Yeah, with cable news, we now have people listening to the news that they want to hear. We've lost sort of the public square where everyone has the opportunity to engage, and we have the internet, which allows everyone to engage, but we self-select into our certain microcosms. So, in my opinion, the best thing we could do is walk next door to our neighbors and ask them, talk to them. When you talk to people face-to-face, you remove a lot of that angst, where when we're behind the keyboard or yelling at the TV, we can get very fired up and angry. But then you walk next door and you meet a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, and you talk about how can we make our community better. That's what we need to get back to, is just good old grassroots politics where we actually look each other in the eye and talk to each other.
Should the Serve America movement try to find a home on television, on radio, in social media in order to provide an antidote to the culture warriors?
Well, that's what we're doing. We have, if you go to joinsam.org, or we also have the Sam Studio, we have a podcast where we're trying to get some different perspectives on there. We're active on social media, but we're also moving forward with getting candidates out there, because there's a lot of great groups who are trying to advocate for good things like No Labels or Fair Districts PA or openprimaries.org. There's some really good folks doing great advocacy work. But I think the biggest thing is that Sam can bring to the table is running actual candidates in some of these state house, Senate races, congressional races, and then forcing the dialogue to be broader, to be more inclusive, to actually listen to the needs of that individual community. So we're agnostic as to the individual ideology of each candidate. We want them to have a process that says we want to engage, we want to listen, we want to reform government so that more people can participate in the electoral process.
So, Ethan Demme, traditionally it has been challenging for a third-party candidate to get on the ballot in Pennsylvania. How do you see that going with Sam candidates?
Well, the thing is, in the last couple of years, there's been some changes in Pennsylvania. It is very difficult for third parties to get any traction. But what you're seeing in Pennsylvania, the elimination of straight party balloting, so you have to choose candidates when you go to the polls. You can't choose a party. That's a big shift. And then currently, the ballot access requirements are now, for the first time in Pennsylvania, an equal playing field. So any candidate can run. The signature requirements are the same for third-party candidates as they are for major party candidates. So those two factors, I think, will play well for us in 2022.
You'd taken a swing at both major political parties in Pennsylvania for having worked to keep independents off the ballot. With these changes, do you see that sentiment changing among the major parties in the state?
There's some glimmers of light. I mean, there's definitely good lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who have proposed legislation to open up our primaries. That would be a big one. Right now, you're ineligible to vote if you're not registered with a major party, but your tax dollars still pay for that election. If the parties want to have a closed primary, then they should pay for it. But if the taxpayers have to pay for it, then everyone should be eligible to vote in the primaries. So open primaries is one, but that's a bipartisan bill in the Senate right now that could open up Pennsylvania primaries.
Political success, of course, can be heavily dependent on funding. Who is supporting the Serve America Movement Party at this time?
Well, currently we're getting some seed funding. Think of us like a startup. So the national organization is helping us with building out our party infrastructure and getting us sort of brand identification in Pennsylvania, trying to get the word out. But then once we start to get established, we'll be doing local fundraising here in Pennsylvania, and our candidates will be doing their own fundraising as well. So we're starting with some seed funds from the national group, which is very helpful, but then we'll be shifting over to local funding after that.
Yeah. You've got a big challenge ahead of you, Ethan Demme. I mean, the culture, in changing the culture, Senate President Pro Tem Jay Corman is still agitating for a partisan review of the 2020 election results and figuratively threw fellow State Senator Doug Mastriano under the bus recently for not making that happen. Are you optimistic about the success of the Serve America movement?
I'm optimistic. There's over 60% of Americans and lots of folks in Pennsylvania who really want a third party to be successful. I also am pragmatic enough to recognize that it's an uphill battle. So we're not looking at a 1 year quick movement. We're here to build a political movement that runs for multiple years. You can have a couple independent candidates. Our state party chair in Texas, Bill King, I mentioned this in the podcast the other day. He said, when you have one candidate run, you can maybe make a dent in that election. But you do need a party structure to sort of keep that momentum going from year to year. So our goal is to recruit candidates and run, but then keep that momentum building from 2022 to 2023 and beyond. So we're here for the long haul, and we're trying to make a difference to make Pennsylvania better.
All right. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Ethan Demme is Pennsylvania Party Chair of the Serve America Movement. Stay tuned. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we speak with Philadelphia Inquirer sports reporter Marcus Hayes about the Eagles, the Phillies, the Sixers, and much more. And we'll take your calls and questions as well.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Philadelphia sports scene is rarely dull. The Eagles have a new young coach with a fondness for rock, paper, scissors, a relatively new young starting quarterback, we think, and some really promising rookie players. But even so, there's been major stumbling in preseason play with regular season and the Atlanta Falcons just weeks away. Also, what are the odds the Phillies will play baseball in October? It's been 10 years, and the Sixers are putting a lot of faith in one of the final remaining pieces of the process, awarding Joel Embiid a contract extension worth nearly $200 million. Will it pay off? Questions or comments? Here's the number, 888-477-9499. Send an email to radiotimes at whyy.org or a tweet at whyyradiotimes. We welcome Marcus Hayes back to the Regional Roundup. He is a Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist. Hello, Marcus. How have you been?
Hello, Mary. How are you?
Just fine, thank you. And earlier when I said a relatively new young starting quarterback, we think that means we're not sure he's starting at this point. I mean, we're going to get to that in just a moment, talking about Jalen Hurts, of course. But first, let's get to preseason so far. Two losses, the second head-scratching, thumping at the hands of New England, 35-0. Jalen Hurts, the presumed starting quarterback was out with a stomach infection on Thursday. And what we saw from the Birds in particular in backup Joe Flacco wasn't pretty, Marcus.
No, it wasn't. It's funny. We're talking about the backup quarterback on a team that doesn't necessarily have a starting quarterback yet, but that just tells you how in the weeds we are in Philadelphia. Yeah, Joe Flacco's finest hours are long behind him, and it was intriguing that Howie Roseman, the Eagles general manager, signed him as the backup to Jalen Hurts this year, considering Jalen Hurts is an unproven commodity for starts in a rookie season last year that didn't go particularly well. And not a whole lot behind Joe Flacco. So the rest of the team is pretty talented and pretty pedigreed, but the quarterback situation is very specious at this point. Yeah.
Well, the headline on a Friday's column was "The Birds Must Trade for Big Play Nick. It would be the best Act 3 since Hamlet." You're talking about bringing Nick Foles back.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, this is a relevant season because you have so many Philadelphia Eagles whose windows are closing or just opening. And in that situation, if you don't have a star quarterback, you have to have a quarterback who can at least keep the trains running on time. I believe Joe Flacco showed us on Thursday night he's not that guy, and you don't know about Jalen Hurts. And this is not a call for Jalen Hurts not to start. It's a call for there to be a better insurance policy behind Jalen Hurts. At this point, Nick Foles is, you know, the third string quarterback on the Chicago Bears. It wouldn't take much to trade for him, maybe a third, fourth, fifth round pick. And he's affordable. His salary and Flacco's together would be $7.5 million, which is about how much money Nick Foles made as an Eagles backup years ago. So to me, it's an easy and elegant solution. And I believe Jalen Hurts, even as a second year player, would be able to handle the shadow of Nick Foles, of whom there is a statue outside the Lincoln Financial Field for winning the Super Bowl and being its MVP after the 2017 season.
Well, especially since Nick Foles is such a nice guy, you can picture him as nothing but supportive of Jalen Hurts.
Well, and there's an interesting dynamic to both Jalen Hurts and Nick Foles. We talk a lot about Christianity or religion in sports, and a lot of guys talk the talk, but both Nick Foles and Jalen Hurts, in my experience, are very much walkers of the walk. They're good teammates, they're good people, and they're very consistent in their actions. So I think that dynamic would help that quarterback room if it ever came to pass.
So again, head coach Nick Sirianni refuses to name Hurts as his starting quarterback. What does naming the starter do for the player and the team?
For the player, you're no longer auditioning. It's kind of like when you get into a relationship and you tell each other, okay, we're not going to see any other people. There's a level of comfort then that you can embrace on the quarterback side, on Jalen Hurts' side. On the player's side, they really need to know who their leader is. Since Carson Wentz was benched after the 12th game in 2020, this team's leader has been Jalen Hurts. Immediately, he was the leader. He was a better leader immediately than Carson Wentz ever was. That's just his personality. That's not necessarily a slam on Carson Wentz. That said, he's also a better leader than Joe Flacco. Again, there's nothing that is not to denigrate Joe Flacco. Jalen Hurts is a special person. I don't know if he's as good a quarterback as he is a person, or as strong a quarterback as he is a person, but the team needs to know that, especially a team with veterans like Fletcher Cox, their Pro Bowl, All-Pro defensive tackle, who will be in the Hall of Fame one day. They're very, very good, very, very pedigreed, very accomplished right side of their offensive line, Jason Kelce, Brandon Brooks, Lane Johnson, and especially the young receivers, Devontae Smith, the first-round pick this year, Jalen Reagor, the first-round pick last year, and Quez Watkins, a sixth-round pick last year, who's almost as fast as DeSean Jackson was.
Wow. You threw out a great line, Marcus. If Hurts were to struggle, quote, Roseman dials the Texans and says, Houston, we have a problem. And we're talking about the Eagles GM, Howie Roseman. Texans are apparently looking to trade DeSean Watson. Is that correct? Watson wants to go. He's outstanding as a quarterback, but is involved in a criminal investigation. And nearly two dozen women have sued him in civil court. So what is the likelihood that he ends up in Philadelphia should Hurts struggle this season?
You know, Jeffrey Lurie, the Eagles owner, who is a longtime, ferocious and vocal advocate of women, has in the past taken on guys with a lot of baggage, most notably Michael Vick. And while dogfighting and gambling aren't the same kind of crimes, if Deshaun Watson has committed a crime, the same kinds of offenses that Deshaun Watson is accused of, Jeffrey Lurie has exhibited a stomach for ne'er-do-wells and miscreants if Deshaun Watson turns out to be a ne'er-do-well or miscreant. Yeah, yeah. So that said, I do believe they want to see if Jalen Hurts can play. It's a much cheaper option. They would retain the three first-round picks that they would probably have to give up in order to get Deshaun Watson. And he might be really good. He was really good at Alabama, lost his job. He was really good at Oklahoma, was a Heisman Trophy candidate. I think he finished second in the voting and had one of the great college seasons in history at Oklahoma after transferring, and was mentally strong. People forget that he spent a year at Alabama and graduated after he lost his job. So he can handle anything, even assuming he doesn't get traded, even the arrival of a player like Deshaun Watson.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see what happens. So you wrote this morning that developing the Eagles' wideouts is more important than developing a quarterback, and we're talking about Jalen Reagor and also Devontae Smith.
Yeah, and Quez Watkins as well, and maybe even J.J. Arcega-Whiteside, who as a second-round pick 3 years ago has been a bust so far. That said, obviously you need to develop Jalen Hurts. You need to have him come along. But you can't waste a season developing Jalen Hurts if Jalen Hurts struggles. Devontae Smith is a plug-and-play wide receiver, which is becoming more common as the college schemes are more wide receiver oriented. He could be as good as Justin Jefferson, who last year the Eagles passed over in favor of Jalen Reagor, but who last year caught 1,400 yards worth of passes and set a rookie record for the Vikings. That's how good Devontae Smith can be right away. Mm-hmm. Reagor has shown great promise in the slot, you know, that inside receiver.
Yeah.
And Quez Watkins, he runs a 4.3-second 40-yard dash. That's almost as fast as DeSean Jackson and Michael Vick. So they have difference makers at the receiver position. Maybe the biggest difference makers they've had since Jeremy Maclin and DeSean Jackson were paired in 2009. But in 2009, they had Donovan McNabb, who went to his, I believe, fifth or sixth Pro Bowl that season. It's a different paradigm right now. So if Jalen Hurts struggles, there has to be a viable plan B for the rest of the team.
All right. So despite the two preseason losses, I'm hearing that we might want to take heart as Eagles fans. There are some possibilities on this team.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I
potential.
Mean, when okay. the schedule came out, and I assumed that Jalen Hurts would be the quarterback, and I assumed that everyone would be relatively healthy, especially their offensive line. And I can't overstate how important Jason Kelce at center, Brandon Brooks at right guard, and Lane Johnson at right tackle. I can't overstate how important they are that they stay healthy in their 30s now. They can win 10, 12 games. They play in a horrible division, and they have good players on both sides of the ball. Their defensive secondary is stronger. It's a year in. I don't dislike this coaching staff. I can't say I like them because they're very young and they're all new, but I don't dislike this coaching staff. And they seem to be the biggest, I guess, positive was in the first half against the Pittsburgh Steelers, which was the first game, the first preseason game, Jalen Hurts and the first team offense did not look lost. They didn't make a bunch of mistakes. They did things properly.
That's faint praise, faint praise, Marcus.
It is.
They didn't
but when
look
you have
lost.
A young coach, a first-time coach, and a first-time quarterback, and a whole bunch of moving parts, and no real offseason. They didn't have their normal, OTA season. That was the thing I looked for, and that's what I saw. I saw a team that knew what it was doing.
Okay. Well, listen, before we move on to the Phillies, just one more question. You did a little thought experiment recently in which you asked, should the Eagles have hired Frank Reich instead of Doug Peterson? Do you think the Birds would have been Super Bowl winners in Super Bowl 52 had they hired Reich?
You know, I don't see why not. I mean, Frank Reich was a huge influence on that team's success. I think we give Doug a little bit too much credit for the actual development of Carson Wentz, the inclusion of Nick Foles. Carson Wentz's second year, he was an MVP candidate. That was largely due to Frank Reich, not necessarily Doug Peterson. the question for me would be, could Frank Reich have done all that and been the head coach? Because being the head coach, about 30-40% of the job has nothing to do with coaching the team. I don't see why not. You know, John DeFilippo was an excellent quarterbacks coach. They had a really, really good staff, high character guys, and tons of talent. I don't see why that wouldn't have happened. And if you remember, Frank Reich was the guy who was Carson Wentz's greatest champion when Carson Wentz was still in college.
Yeah. Well, a lot of that year was also kismet too. Nick Foles hit his stride just at the right moment down the stretch. So, yeah,
it was
with Carson Wentz
again.
Yeah.
Again, Frank Reich is the guy who designed the Nick Foles play. He went to Nick Foles and said, listen, what plays are you comfortable with? And all of a sudden we had all these RPOs and deep shots and play. It was wonderful coaching. And that is not to diminish what Doug did, because the buck stops with him. But if the question is, could Frank Reich have done it too? Yes, I think so.
Okay. Phillies maddeningly. Oh, I'm not even going to try that word this morning. Just inconsistent. You know, they're on a tear one moment, then they're in a slide. You know, swept by Arizona. They did win the series against the Padres, but it was tough. What are you looking at with this team down the stretch? I mean, last week you were optimistic before they hit Arizona and San Diego, and now we're not so sure.
I was optimistic because I thought Rhys Hoskins, their right-handed slugger, their cleanup hitter, would come back before the sixth game of the six-game road trip. When he came back, they clobbered the San Diego Padres. They're 8-2 in Rhys Hoskins' last 10 starts. He's dealing with a groin injury. And when those last 10 starts were forced, I think it was five starts, injury, three starts, injury, one start, something like that. So whatever the math is, he's hitting .455 with five home runs, five doubles, and 13 RBIs.
Yeah.
He's got 15 hits, and 10 of them are for extra bases. And the interruptions don't seem to matter. So I predicted that they would do better, maybe with him as a pinch hitter. He just really affects the lineup. And the person he seems to affect the most is JT Realmuto, the all-star catcher, who was 6-41 going into yesterday's game. Rhys Hoskins comes back into the lineup. JT Realmuto goes 2-for-4 with a two-run homer. So him being around affects everything. And when Dave Dombrowski, the new general manager, put this team together, he knew two things. He knew that – well, three things. He knew that, number one, they would have two starting pitchers they could count on in Aaron Nola and Zach Wheeler, maybe three in Zach Eflin. He knew the bullpen would be a question mark and likely would struggle at times. But more than anything else, he knew that they were going to be poor defensively. He believed that the team could be a playoff contender because of the lineup. With Rhys Hoskins in the lineup, they're a playoff contender. With Rhys Hoskins out of the lineup, they are not.
So Hoskins is back. One more question. Do you think they are a contender? I mean, the Braves are on a tear. They're first in the NL East. I think the Phillies are five out right now.
And they're five out of the second wild card spot, which Cincinnati owns. And they don't play any of the wild card teams again, so they can't control their destiny there. But I was looking at the numbers yesterday. They have the easiest schedule down the stretch of any of the contenders. The Braves don't have a terrible schedule, but they have a tough schedule coming up. The Yankees, Giants, and Dodgers, all very, very good teams. Then they're at Colorado, which is a team that's good at home. Said, I think the Phillies, who are 63-61, probably have to get to 90 wins, which I believe means they have to go 27-11 down the stretch. That's not undoable. That's not impossible, especially considering the teams they face. Again, you know, they see the Diamondbacks again, the Nationals, and the Marlins, who always seem to be a thorn in their side. Those are their next opponents after Tampa Bay comes in for two beginning tomorrow.
Okay, promise this question. We've got 30 seconds. The Sixers, you've got a lot to say about the $196 million contract extension they just gave to Joel Embiid. Has he earned this? Will it prove to be worth it? Now we've got 20 seconds, Marcus. Sorry about that.
Well, honestly, this tells me, number one, they kind of had to do it. They have to have somebody to represent the process, which is entering its eighth or ninth year. But they believe that Joel Embiid has matured. No more Twitter wars, no more social media outbursts. He's eating better, he's sleeping better, and he's a dad. Little Arthur Embiid might be the MVP of the Sixers.
Okay, Marcus Hayes, as always, great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And enjoy the rest of the summer. Marcus is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producer, Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings-Jordan. Thanks for joining us, and be well.